Thank you. Well, I'm really delighted to be here. It's wonderful to be among so many people interested in happiness. My project is a little different from the other most of the work you've heard before. It's really a normative argument rather than an empirical argument. And in normative political theory, we still get away without using PowerPoint. So I hope you'll be able to follow my talk, since it's only a theoretical argument about what we should want rather than details about the policy of implementing it. So I hope that it'll be clear to you what the happiness connection is, although when I wrote the paper, this is a chapter of a book, I wasn't invoking the term happiness, but the project is very much motivated by what I see as the great unhappiness, which exists because of our current structures of work and of care. And specifically, one of the issues is the worldwide spreading of the dysfunctional structures of work and care that characterize North America and increasingly Europe. And this is some form of a global care chain where poor women are imported, sometimes from other countries, sometimes from the villages, to do the care work because so many countries have decided that the only path to true gender equality is full-time work for women without trying to figure out how the care work is now going to be done. So one brief note is that I'm speaking with respect to the wealthy countries of the world because the project that I'm going to propose will have a significant and I think desirable impact on reduction in both consumption and production of material goods. But this isn't necessarily what is needed in all parts of the world. So you should hear this as a claim about rich countries and think about what modifications would be necessary in the developing world. I'm not going to say very much here about the background work that I draw on. I'll just note a few of you may know the pathbreaking work by Nancy Fraser called Beyond the Family Wage. This work carries that idea forward. And there are many, many care theorists out there whose work I draw on. And I'm really looking forward to hearing from you about the empirical work that you do that may facilitate mine, because of course I both draw on and require empirical evidence to back up the kinds of things I'm going to say. And I see that I've already missed some relevant panels and I went home for a nap to catch up from the jet lag. Okay, so here's the basic claim. Western societies face three critical problems that arise out of dysfunctional norms of work and care. First, unsustainable stress on families. Second, persistent inequality for women and others who do care work. And policymakers who are ignorant about the care work that life requires. We urgently need collective deliberation about radical transformation of these norms. And I have a proposal that I hope will spark that deliberation. So let me open with an example of a very recent change in norms that captures the kind of change that I'll be proposing here. A friend of mine asked a young male colleague at a Swedish university whether he would be taking the full paternity leave available to him when his wife had their first child, or whether he would feel career pressure not to take the leave. And he answered, "Are you kidding? If I didn't take the leave, all my colleagues would be saying, who knew he was a money-grubbing careerist?" So from concern about undermining one's career by taking paternal leave, which still exists as a serious concern everywhere, the norms had so changed in his sphere, he did say it didn't cover all of Sweden, that to fail to take the leave would subject one to the disapproval of one's colleagues. That's the kind of change I'm looking for. My project here is to radically change the kinds of things that generate approval and disapproval among one's colleagues, friends, families, neighbors, society in general. Although I'm hoping the new norms will be fostered more by support and encouragement than by disapproval. I'm advocating new norms about how everyone should engage in employment and in unpaid care work. Specifically, my proposal is that all mature, competent adults are expected to be employed part-time, or what we would now call part-time, no less than 12 and no more than 30 hours a week, and to do unpaid care work part-time, also somewhere between 12 and 30 hours a week. People would encourage one another to resist the pressure of taking on more work and support and appreciate the care they do, as well as the leisure time they take. In short, the new norms would generate a collectively supported shift in how people allocate their time, indeed, how they experience time itself, as the pressures of widespread time poverty are eroded. Conversely, the failure to meet these norms by working long hours or failing to participate in care would generate the sort of concern, disapproval, embarrassment, pity, unease that currently would arise if a competent adult male announced at a party that he had never held a job. One might, for example, offer a workaholic advice on where to get help. But whether the response was kindly or disapproving, it would be clear that an important norm was being violated. Thus, new norms of work and care would be enforced by serious social constraint, like most norms, but not by law enforced by the state. My argument is that without such norm transformation, we cannot hope to solve the three pressing problems I noted at the outset that in various forms afflict all Western societies. So now let me briefly say a bit more about each problem. The first is the unsustainable structure of work and family life that puts enormous stress on families and forces workers at all levels into untenable choices between work and family. This stress has serious consequences, including health and autonomy, for all, and almost certainly harms children with long-term intergenerational consequences. The second problem is equality. Care work is organized around categories of hierarchy and disadvantage. Many of these categories, such as race, class, ethnicity, and citizenship status, carry with them long legacies of coercion and disrespect, which still shape the structure of care. As long as only a subset of the population does the care work, both the work and the people who do it will be denigrated. Societies can only achieve equality when the distribution of care is just. So this is not just about gender equality. I think you cannot remove the destructive hierarchical categories of any society unless you undo their connection to care. Of course, the most obvious and intersecting category is gender. The shift in gender norms and the inequality of women improves at a glacial pace, leaving women with less pay, less economic security, vulnerability to poverty, less leisure time, less access to top jobs, and to other advantages, including high-quality health care. This inequality is tied to, although of course not exclusively caused by, women's unequal share of care responsibilities. The failure to achieve equitable care arrangements affects both autonomy and democracy. Women who come home from a full day of work to another 4 to 6 hours of care work do not have time for either personal or political reflection. They do not have time to advocate for gender equality or anything else in their workplace or in electoral politics. Indeed, some version of this corrosive time poverty extends to men as well. The current structures of work and care are a recipe not only for a wide variety of social ills, but for a population too stressed and exhausted to protest them. The third problem is that least commented on in the now extensive literature on care. I call it the policy care divide. This means that those in top policymaking positions are almost always people with very little experience of the demands or satisfactions or importance of caretaking. In my view, this means that policymakers are, for the most part, ignorant of a core dimension of human life. This renders them unfit for the job. We should no more consider electing someone without substantial experience in caregiving to public office or appointing them CEO of a corporation than we would someone who had never held a job. Those who do have the expert knowledge and experience, primarily women, have very little access to high-level policymaking positions. My claim is that the knowledge of care is essential to good policymaking and that the necessary knowledge can only be acquired by hands-on experience. Reading reports or novels or talking to one's mother is not a substitute. To ensure that everyone has the capacity to make and evaluate policy, everyone needs substantial experience in providing care. Now, many efforts to make the gendered division of care compatible with gender equality run afoul of this concern of fixing the care policy divide. For example, wages for housework or well-paid long-term maternity leave or part-time work that is overwhelmingly taken up by women or pensions for homemakers will not solve the policy care divide. Only breaking the link between care and categories of privilege and disadvantage can do it. In sum, my claim is that none of the problems outlined above can be fixed unless everyone, with no exceptions, participates in part-time unpaid care and part-time paid work. Now let me briefly define what I mean by care. There are a lot of different definitions out there in the literature, which is perfectly appropriate because it's invoked for different projects. For my purposes, what I mean is care directed at particular people, which might include a household or another small group or even those who live on a particular city block or part of a church or community organization. The kind of care I have in mind includes the usual range of household labor, cleaning, shopping, cooking, bathing children, children's diapers, taking a kid to school, helping her with her homework, doing laundry, as well as shoveling sidewalks from snow. We do that a lot in Toronto. Reading to someone sick or elderly, bringing them meals, talking to someone who is lonely, helping someone who is depressed find help. I don't use the term face-to-face care because shoveling snow or cleaning someone's kitchen or toilet is not really face-to-face care. I want to include both intimate, or what sometimes people call nurturant care, and the more mundane, material, non-nurturant care like cleaning or shoveling. But I want to limit what counts for one's care responsibilities to care that builds personal connections. I think this is important for learning about the demands and the rewards and the importance of care for people's well-being. One way of putting it, to which I'll return, is that when one receives the kind of care I have in mind, it makes one feel valued. It affirms one's sense of worth. It makes one feel cared for, cared about. It allows both caregiver and receiver to feel mutual appreciation and satisfaction. It's important here that the norms I propose would foster patterns in which almost everybody is, to some extent, both a caregiver and a care receiver. So this whole approach would break that categorization of, say, the elderly are the care receivers, the young people, the rest of us are caregivers, the rest of us women anyway, so that everybody is both a caregiver and a care receiver. So now a brief word about norm change. Norms are an important challenge for the idea of democratic deliberation. Some of the most powerful norms, like gender norms, that women should care for their family and the expectation that adult males should be employed full-time, are so deeply entrenched that they seem like facts of life rather than collective choices about how we should live. But they are collective choices, and they're subject to change. Everyone knows that the norms about women's employment have changed. And you might remember from novels or movies that there was a time when to be a gentleman meant that the man was not employed. It was a mark of superiority, not failure. In North America, people might also remember the more recent phrase, banker's hours, suggesting that men in that elite line of work could play golf in the afternoon. That, of course, is a far cry from the hours that now characterize employment in the financial sector. Indeed, it's one of the most interesting puzzles about recent norm change, that those at the top of many professions, such as elite lawyers and financiers, have transformed their work life from affording significant leisure to a hellish number of weekly hours. Of course, this means that what causes norm change is complex and not simply a matter of choice. Norms shape people's lives. They're coercive and exclusionary by nature. A norm is not a norm unless most people feel pressure to abide by it, and unless those who deviate from it experience some form of sanction. It's therefore essential that societies develop modes of democratic deliberation about norms, not just laws. There's a lot of literature on democratic deliberation in the political science world, but it's mostly about laws and not about norms. In this case of norms of work and care, I mean by democratic deliberation conversations everywhere by everyone. Playgrounds, cafes, classrooms, water coolers, boardrooms. It's urgent that people ask everywhere, what do they want in their norms of work and care? What should they be? What is it that we should expect of reasonable, competent adults? How do we want to live? So I'm writing a short, I hope, accessible book. It will include an introduction to the problem and a change in norms that I propose as the solution. I'll elaborate the problems. I have chapters on the different solutions, one part on care, which is what you're going to hear today, one part on work. And there are two additional chapters on the political economy by a co-author, which argues that the legal background changes that will be necessary are in fact perfectly feasible and more or less compatible with contemporary capitalism. So one final word in background general about how I see this proposal that I'm making. I sometimes refer to this as the CARE Manifesto. And this term highlights the tension between a blueprint or program for what is to be done and the goal of public deliberation on the issues. The tension appears to rise because if one has the answers to what is to be done in advance, what is the point of deliberation? The resolution of the tension in this case comes from my sense of the urgent need to shift the existing public conversation about work-family balance. There's a huge amount of literature, conversation in the public press, in blogs, in management literature, in academic scholarship, but I think the vast majority of it is merely tinkering at the edges, discussing things like more flexible work hours. The problem is that conditions, particularly in North America, are so dire that such solutions are desperately needed, and so they rightly command attention. However, they cannot begin to make the fundamental changes necessary to resolve the problems I've outlined. So the point of this little book, Part-Time for All, is to change this ongoing conversation about work-family balance. That is, it's aimed at public deliberation. And in my view, a concrete proposal of an alternative, however utopian it may sound, will help that conversation. So many people are unhappy with the current norms around work and care, but cannot envision the kind of alternative that would really make a difference. I want to offer an alternative to spark that conversation. So now I'm going to turn in to offer you some of the key points of the care argument. But I need to say two things about what will be in the work chapter, which I won't be presenting. So the first is that while I try to minimize the transformations, the economic transformations that would have to happen in order for these norm changes to take place, there's one thing that is required, and that is a new version of the living wage. So I hope many of you will remember there was a time, not very long ago at all, when there was the norm of a family wage, a living wage, which meant a man should be able to earn enough in 40 hours a week to support himself and his family, his wife and three children. My model is that there should be, and of course that living wage norm was not a law. It was not minimum wage, it was a norm, very widely respected across many sectors. And the new norm should be that one person can support herself and a child on 20 hours a week. So you can see it's not a big difference. Capitalism thrived under the family wage. Of course, I know there are global capitalism issues here. But in terms of the functioning of the economy on a model of 20 hours should be able to support one person and one child, That's not a deviation from the living wage that characterized work structures in North America for many years. The second change is a really big and complicated one, which I just want to note. I thought it actually had echoes of the conversation we heard this morning between Carol and Bob Zudgen on what I thought of as the striving for the best. And this has to do with the conception of excellence. So when I advocate that everybody work part-time and do unpaid care work part-time, one of the things this challenges is that the idea that to be excellent at something is to do it single-mindedly. And this covers all areas. So, you know, when you listen to the Olympics, you're hearing about these 12-year-olds who have never done anything but skate. And it's offered as this model of commitment and achievement. And I think that, of course, musicians are another category. This is, I think, our contemporary model of excellence and therefore success. And I think it's very destructive. I don't want to suggest that there would be no costs to undermining it, and I want to, that's why I'm highlighting this, because I think this sort of a move would very substantially challenge this whole understanding of what excellence is and what we ought to aspire to in a satisfying life. Okay, so another background point, now I am turning to the care issues. One of the concerns that sometimes people have when they listen to this project is that they worry that this is a privatization of care. Now, the obligation to care that I propose will be unpaid, so it's outside the market. This is not wages for housework. This is not about greater marketization of care. The care work I'm advocating will be unpaid. And, as I'll explain shortly, it will extend beyond the family, so the nexus between care and market will be disrupted, the nexus between family and care will be disrupted, and it will not be provided by the state. But the entire project is premised on the idea of care as both a collective and an individual obligation. There will be collective conversations about the nature of the obligations, and the very idea of strong norms that everybody participates reflects the sense that care is a collective as well as an individual responsibility. The broad point here is that the recognition of something as a collective responsibility does not automatically translate into the judgment that the state is the best means for meeting that responsibility. Even if, as here, there will be the need for some background legal facilitation. But the main shift is not about asking the state to provide the necessary care. Okay, so now I'm going to turn to some of the details of the new norms of care I'm proposing. So the first question, to whom does one provide care? So I begin with the family, as I think there are particularly compelling care responsibilities within families, and very often, though not always, family members are particularly well suited to provide the care that is needed. And when I refer to family, I'm bearing in mind that family forms are rapidly changing. I expect the new norms of care that I'm proposing to facilitate care in a wide variety of families, thus making it easier for people in relationships other than the once traditional heterosexual two-parent family. But a central recommendation is that care obligations should extend beyond the family. One of the important things one learns when one does care, and often fails to understand when one doesn't, is that it matters who does the care for whom. Caregivers are often not interchangeable. I think people learn this most often in the family. A sick or sad child wants a parent often, even a particular parent, for comfort. And people often urgently want to be able to be there for a child, a spouse, a sibling, an elderly parent who is suffering and needs care. The family is also, therefore, the source of demands for care. The part-time care hours I propose need to be enough for family members to meet most of the individual and collective care needs of their household. For people with young children, the time demands of the list I gave of what constitutes care may cover most of their care responsibilities. For those people whose responsibilities for family and friends are not too demanding at a given time, the expectation would be that they would form wider communities of care in which they would meet their care responsibilities. So now I'll just say a word about that. The new norm would generate expectations of caring attention to the needs of one's neighbors and one's community, however defined. This, of course, is a demanding norm. In particular, it means that one's care obligations would not simply be defined by the arc of an individual life. Intense obligation when one's children were young or one's parents were frail or in ill health, with the expectation that these intense obligations would decrease over time. Another way of highlighting the demanding nature of what I propose is this. One can never retire from care. I think about this a lot because I'm at this stage. My kids are in their 20s. So I'm at this stage where I would turn my care responsibilities outward to a wider community. So how would people choose and create communities of care? It's a complicated question. I don't propose to provide a blueprint. I expected it would evolve differently in different contexts. I picture a wide variety of communities. For some, their geographical neighborhood, the people who live close to them, would form the community within which they create norms of mutual care. These norms would be reciprocal in the widest sense, that everyone in the community is expected to participate and to benefit, but not in the quid pro quo sense, that I repay the care you give me with similar care. Now, there would be collective concerns. I'm not going to go into the details. Of course, other people might choose faith communities. They might choose workplaces. They might choose places of interest. There would be many different ways in which one would constitute these communities of care. I just want to note here that there would need to be a collective attention to ensuring that everyone is included in some community, and puzzles around different capacities arising from income inequality as well as other forms of disadvantage. So now let me turn to some of what I think of as the big puzzles and problems that would be faced by any community that was trying to implement these norms. I think one of the most fundamental problems, especially at this time, a time of transformation to these new norms, is the powerful urge, and indeed current norm, to avoid doing care on the grounds that what one is doing instead is really important, and the kind of thing that not just anyone could do, unlike lowly care. So in order to avoid such resistance, I think of this as one of the most powerful forms of resistance to this project, I propose a variety of positions as starting points for discussions around what counts as care and who should get a pass, this is Joan Trano's phrase, from care obligations. In thinking about hard cases, I think we can see more clearly why care is important for everyone, meaning as both receiver and provider. So the first sort of potentially hard case is, well, what if your paid work involves care, like being a doctor or a teacher? Should that person be relieved of unpaid care obligations? So think about this first in terms of care of oneself. Under current norms, a specialized surgeon might well think that he should not waste his time cooking and cleaning. And even those who can avoid a sense of self-importance might believe that it would be a waste of their valuable and perhaps publicly financed training to spend time on such menial chores. But I suggest that such a stance raises the question, is there anyone who we think is too important, too specially talented or trained to pick up his own socks and wash them, or feed himself and wash the dishes? Of course, this question cannot really be answered without considering the demands of work. In addition to the issues of privilege and status, so being too busy and important to care is a big part of what it counts as being an important person in our world, I think part of the resistance to acknowledging an obligation even to care for oneself instead of relying on others, paid and unpaid, to do it for one, is that for many people the demands of work are so overwhelming, and in the best of cases so compelling, that if it's possible to get others to take up the chores of care, that seems urgently desirable. I think people cannot take seriously the idea of doing a lot more care unless they can also envision a radical reduction in the demands of paid work. So now here's another way of thinking about the question of who shouldn't have to pick up their own socks or wash their children's. It's addressing the care responsibilities of people who make it their life work to fight for important causes, like reducing poverty or protecting the environment. Some who might remain unmoved by the claims, either individual or social, of the importance of the surgeon, would not want to see effective activists distracted from their work by demands of care. Indeed, there might be people who advocate for publicly supported daycare or better care for the elderly who would claim that they make their contribution to care of others and indeed the social recognition of the importance of care through their activism. And here too, time presses. Think of those who work to organize international relief for those in war zones or facing natural disaster. For these people, just as for the high-powered lawyer or financier, there are never enough hours in the day as it is. Should some of those precious hours be taken for direct care? Now, in the chapter on work, I argue that the norms I propose would allow for periods of intense work. So the emergency aid worker might need to be totally devoted to her work for weeks, perhaps even months at a time. But I propose this to be compensated by time off and time for missed care obligations. It is not a substitute for care obligation. So why not? Part of the reason, as I already briefly referred to, is the need for experiential knowledge. Those who advocate for better policies around care do not, in the course of that work, acquire the experiential knowledge of providing direct, hands-on care. Equally important is the role of care in creating human connection and the importance of fair distribution of care work. Even people who are doing vital work in promoting care in the world should not be encouraged to disregard the immediate care needs around them that will shape the core relationships in their lives. Similarly, if we are ever to have a just distribution of care work, we must resist all forms of the argument that important people, or people doing important work, don't need to do care work. Finally, no one should be excluded from the complex set of benefits that flow from being embedded in care networks. Under general norms of care by all, people so isolated would in some ways be excluded not just from satisfactions and capacities, but from a kind of social citizenship. Now, maybe we'll have time in that discussion to talk a little bit about the ways in which the categories of care and work are themselves intrinsically arbitrary. So I think of as mentoring as part of work, but I code spending time with a panic-stricken student as care. These are inevitably arbitrary distinctions, and I think under these new norms, every community would be talking about what counts as work and care, see the ways in which care has to be part of work, and that caring is, of course, a form of work. So the categories would never be static, and we acknowledge that they're inevitably arbitrary, but they are necessary to get this transformation going. So just to sum up about the idea of who gets a pass, so activists don't get a pass. Activism is not care. But I would say that the new norms should also encourage activism and community work, as well as unpaid care and paid work. Community work forms part of the networks of bonds and paths for transformation that make for thriving democracy and satisfying community. But as we do that, we have to avoid the dangers of slipping back into old patterns of treating direct care as of less value, less important than the public contributions of activism or policy recommendations, and thus reverting to both status and gender hierarchies around the division of labor. So one other important point with respect to old patterns. Some paid care would remain under my model. But what would violate the new norms would be to consistently pay others to do the material, non-nurturant care, the dirty work, while doing the intimate care oneself. Even though this is a strategy currently used by many women who can afford it. In fact, probably almost all professional women have relied on exactly this strategy. But to allow that under these new norms would reinforce hierarchies that have long been shaped around status categories such as race. So it cannot be part of the new norms. I talk in the chapter about whether care of the earth counts as care. The answer is yes. Complicated questions of what forms. And I also specifically have added a separate category of self-care. I think of this as particularly important for women, that unless there's a separate dimension of a norm of a certain number of hours for self-care, that will fall out of their time commitments. So one of the things that I think I'm going to talk very briefly about some of the innovations in care that I think would arise out of this transformation, which are part of its benefits, before turning to two of the problems. So there are a lot of different kinds of transformations. One of them might be institutional. For example, you could imagine a structure of tax incentives to encourage the building of apartment buildings and condominiums that included kitchens and play spaces where so it was easy for families to gather to share a meal while their kids are playing next door. This is not an alternative to publicly funded child care and elder care centers with flexible hours, they're just the demand for them would be reduced. But I think the most important innovation that would come would be from imagination about how care needs can be met. Part of the new normative framework would be a widespread sense that everyone has care needs and virtually everyone has some ability to meet those needs of others. The world would no longer be divided up, as I said earlier, between those who need care and those who provide it. I think particularly that we could become much more imaginative about how the elderly who may be in need of some form of care could contribute to the care of others, and I think this would significantly enhance their capacity to feel a sense of purpose in life if they didn't feel as though they were no longer contributing to the care of friends and neighbors. And I think there are lots of ways in which this could be done, and there is a kind of collective failure of imagination about that. So let me now point to what I think of as, in addition to the resistance that important people shouldn't do care, the other true concerns about this model have to do with what I call preference and intrusion. So these problems seem pressing because of the coercive sense of these norms, and which I want to acknowledge. And indeed, as I said before, it's the very coercive power of the norms which means that they need to be democratically debated. And it is also important to remember that right now we organize the structure of care work in particular through the coercion of gender norms as well as the coercion built into status hierarchy. The norms I'm proposing are not more coercive, the coercion is just more obvious because they aim at shifting existing patterns of coercion. So the preference question is this. When I present this argument, I often get the answer, well, you know, what if some people just don't like caregiving? That's not kind of their thing. They contribute to society in other ways. Why should they be forced to do something they don't like? Now, it's important when you think about that objection, you have to remember that we do not expect to hear the objection, comparable objection, around the norm of full-time work for men, even though that norm is increasingly difficult to comply with. You don't hear, well, I'm just not the kind of guy who likes to work, and so I shouldn't have to, you know, I should be fed some other way because I wouldn't be good at it anyway, you know, because I don't like it, which is the argument you hear about care. And of course, the economic consequences of non-compliance with the norms of work are much harsher than the sort of social disapproval that would follow from non-compliance with my norms. So especially with respect to communities of care outside of families, I think there should be enough different ways for people to contribute to care to meet individual preferences, recognizing that we can also expect some shift in preferences as these new norms take hold. Current preferences are so shaped by gender norms and by the denigration of care that we should give them relatively little weight. And this might change after the new norms were well established. And finally, as I already said this briefly, but I can't emphasize it enough, the idea that coerced care will be bad care and that that's a failing of my model ignores the huge amount of economic and norm pressure that shapes the existing structure of care, and there's been some excellent work on tracing the structures of coercion around care work. So the other problem that concerns people is intrusion. So intrusion into intimate relations is another potentially troubling part of the new norms. And there would be a kind of intrusion because how you divide your domestic labor within a household would actually become a matter of collective social concern. And the anxiety about that plays into an old and troubling set of distinctions between the public and the private. Now, of course, existing gender norms currently play a huge role in structuring the division of household labor, and these are further supported by structures of work. There are a variety of studies now that young couples expect to enter into egalitarian relationships around household labor, but then once the first child shows up and they notice the structures of work and the man makes more money, and very quickly it devolves into traditional gender roles, which is then in turn a source of conflict within the relationship because that wasn't actually the expectation of either party. So given the power of existing gender roles backed by the structures of work and even tax structures, it's completely unpersuasive to suggest that the existing household division of labor is just a matter of individual autonomous choice. And I would remind people, too, that we have the very important background issue of domestic violence, where we have come to understand that there is no way of shifting those core norms without trespassing on old categories of public and private. So I think we need to acknowledge the probable resistance in the language of intrusion into a private personal domain, but resist it. Remember where we began, the need to achieve goals of family sustainability, equality, and ending the care policy divide. These are pressing problems shaped by existing norms of work and care, and the goals cannot be achieved without a change in norms. This will involve constraint and a kind of collective attention to practices once coded as private. So now I'm going to close with some additional benefits of the norm change I advocate in addition to solving these three basic problems. So the first really important one is something that is just emerging from a variety of different kinds of evidence that as men become more involved with care, particularly care for children, as masculinity comes to be linked with care, it comes to be de-linked with violence. And as I assume most of you know, the problem of how to end sexual violence, how to end violence of men against women is a problem every society struggles with. And this looks like a really promising avenue. There's a group in Canada that works on violence against women, has for many years, and is now actively involved in a project of encouraging young men to participate in caring for their children because they see that as one of the most promising avenues of changing structures of violence. Another really important benefit, which I'm actually going to be spending quite a bit of time working on next year, but I'll just say it very briefly now. I alluded to it earlier, which is overcoming the harms of time poverty. Indeed, I think shifting, one of the things I expect to happen with these transformation of norms is that people would actually experience time differently. I think the existing time poverty that almost all of us suffer from, and that's one of the ironies, is that the people at the top suffer from it with all their privilege and advantage, and the people at the bottom who are, you know, have three different precarious jobs are also suffering from it. When there is no time, it makes us ungenerous. I think that's one of the really terrible costs of a pervasive time poverty. And it means that care is not a pleasure. If there were the time to care, one could enjoy it, and I think one of the real benefits of that is that the care recipients would feel that the care for them was not a burden, but a pleasure, and that that would transform the nature of the experience for both caregiver and care receiver. And I also think that many of the mundane chores of chopping vegetables and sweeping the floor would also be transformed if they were not always rushed and experienced as intrusions into the pressing demands of both work and care in other domains. And I might mention last, as I got to look at the beautiful lake today, the time for soul-restoring time with nature, which is another casualty of the time poverty of so many people. I also think that there would be vastly increased number of jobs. There would be a greater responsiveness to rapid changes in work, promotion of a sustainable economy, which is hugely important, with the reduction of material consumption and production, facilitating equality among the rapidly emerging varieties of family forms, and reducing child poverty. Norms supporting reflection and receptivity improve both individual and collective judgment, enhancing autonomy and democracy. In particular, the many forms of care that people will engage in will enhance their capacity to take the perspectives of others, and this is crucial to the judgment that democracy requires. So finally, one last cost to the project, which I think is actually a benefit. The collective deliberation about the new norms in one's chosen community of care will take time. But these practices of deliberation are properly understood as promoting what Hannah Arendt would have called relations of freedom, although she would never have thought of it in these terms. She had very strict visions of what was public and what was private. In Arendtian terms, we construct our shared world, the public space that both binds and separates us, through relations of freedom, through free public deliberation about their choices around core values. The issues of care and employment are especially important topics of collective world building because they further dismantle long-standing divides of public and private by bringing care into the public realm of collective deliberation. The very process of doing so brings to light the intertwining of the intimate, family life and sexual bonding, the economic and the political, and the need for all to be subject to collective deliberation. Thank you. Thank you.